Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age?
What is going on, you guys? It is Jake here coming to you on this lovely Friday. We have a little bit of a Hallmark episode here, I'm going to call it. This was Mount Rushmore of the most fun that I've ever had doing an interview. Nerve-wracking, certainly, as well, because it was for a Mount Rushmore guest of mine, David Simon, the creator of The Wire, Homicide, currently We Own the City on HBO. He's a guy who just means a lot to the city of Baltimore, I think. He's still a resident here. And is one of the sort of pioneers of the prestige TV industry as well. He was a reporter for The Sun covering the crime beat before that. He's done a couple books about the Baltimore crime scene as well as the homicide detective unit. So he's just a guy who is sort of a staple here in some respects. He's pretty much an icon. So yeah, this was one that I had dreamed about doing for a long time. I had gotten the contact info sent to me for a while. I saved it for a rainy day. And David is actually now airing a show that he just spent the last year or so of his life working on, We Own This City, which is an adaptation of Justin Fenton's book of the same name. And basically it's about the Gun Trace Task Force in Baltimore and sort of the goings on within that unit. It's a pretty sad story and one that I think he puts it well, picks up sort of right where The Wire leaves off. And we talk a lot about that. We talk a lot about The Wire. We talk about Homicide, which was the book that put him on the scene, and plenty more. So I wanted to sort of preface the interview here by saying, first things first, this one really does not touch on football at all. We don't really do interviews like that too often, but I just wanted to jump in here and let you guys know, in case you were expecting anything like that, to, you know, temper your expectations. It's much more just about David, his career, the shows that hopefully a lot of you are big fans of. I'd recommend going back and watching them if you haven't heard of them yet, and to also watch We Own the City. So we definitely, you know, touch on a lot of topics over several different decades. And I wanted to preface it first by saying that it's not football related. I also wanted to say that it's different in the respect that this one gets a little bit heavier. We touch on topics that are very mature, very political in nature. So if you're one of the people that says, listen, I don't need that in my football podcast, and you want to go ahead and skip this one, that's totally fine. In all honesty, this is kind of just one for me, one that I wanted to do. And I'm really, really glad I did it, because it was one of my favorite chats that I've ever done. David was gracious enough to give me almost an hour of his time. I think we had agreed to like a half an hour via his booking agent. But yeah, that's what we wound up on. I think it was a great chat. I think he enjoyed it as well. And I think it's going to show through here. So first wanted to preface the interview by saying that. I also wanted to kind of go ahead and officially promote the show. It's We Own This City on HBO Max, airing 9 p.m. Monday nights. Check it out. Look into it if you haven't heard of it. Like I said, it's an adaptation of Justin Fenton's book, which I read last year right when it came out. I was really looking forward to the show. And because it was coming out, I figured it was kind of the perfect time to pull the card of asking David to come on and chat about his career. So thankfully, he was amenable to that. And we sat down for, like I said, what was a lengthy, in-depth chat about a lot of different things. So stick around for the interview if you're so inclined, and we'll see you guys again next week. Later.
If you walk through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon. Walk the street and
all right, we now welcome on a very special guest. Definitely a little bit of a bucket lister, I would say, here for me. It's David Simon. How's it going, man?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess for the uninitiated of our fans who might not know, I feel like a lot of people listening to this probably do know you, but how would you describe your relationship with the city of Baltimore in the last 40 or so years of your career here?
Oh, well, I've been a resident of Baltimore since 84, I guess. I grew up outside of Washington, and I came here to be a newspaperman at the Baltimore Sun. And by a series of unlikely accidents and you know, maybe a little bit of luck, I became a television writer and television producer, and I've done television shows, some of which have been here. I just finished one recently, but I've done about three television productions. Oh, I was involved with four, and I've been fully responsible for three in the city of Baltimore. They've all been crime shows, perhaps regrettably for Baltimore, but yeah, that's what I covered in the newspaper.
Yeah, right. And I guess we can kind of start with the newspaper there, because that is ultimately what leads you to the television route. And so crime reporter for the Sun, like you mentioned, in the early 80s, what brought you to the Sun? I know you went to Maryland, so I guess maybe that was sort of a connection.
Was
crime something you always wanted to cover, or were you just kind of assigned to that beat?
No, I was just assigned. I never thought about crime for a minute in terms of journalism until it happened to me. I was the editor of the daily paper at the University of Maryland in College Park. And after I finished doing that, I'd been in college about 4 years, and I had about 2.5 years worth of credits because I basically had majored in University of Maryland Diamondback and not anything else. So I still had to get my degree, and that involved a lot of summer classes and, you know, stacking up internship credits. And so I still had about another 5 years. I had a 5-year career that still was ongoing. And so after I finished being the editor, I became the stringer for the Sun covering College Park. And they also gave me some story assignments in Montgomery and PG in the DC suburbs. So that fifth year of college for me, I had about 100 bylines in the Baltimore Sun. I wrote so much that there was like a polite inquiry from the union about whether or not they were going to hire me, because otherwise I was starting to become a violation, and that I was, you know, writing on spec so much that I should have been a full-time reporter. So they did. They hired me, and they stuck me on the police beat. And that was the first I ever encountered of big city policing or big city crime. It was very improbable. You know, I was a suburban kid from Silver Spring, Maryland, and that's where I landed. And I did that from about 1983, I guess, really effectively. I never got promoted till 1995 when I left the paper. So, there were a couple books that got written, Homicide, The Corner, that were from that reporting. And one of them got, the Homicide, the first one, got made into a television show. And so that door kind of cracked open for me.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that we're also going to touch on. I guess, like, when you were starting out, I'm curious about, in a general sense, and as far as like professionally for you, how would you compare Baltimore then to now, almost 40 years or so? And, you know, like I said, in a general sense, and then like with your job versus what somebody like Justin Fenton would be seeing on a similar beat nowadays.
Well, I had more support than Justin did. I mean, I was one of, when I came on, there were veteran police reporters who were on the beat with me. And I think Justin, probably the beginning of his career, he had some of that going on, but we were fat. The Baltimore Sun was a healthy newspaper. We had, if you include the people running for the zoned, suburban zoned editions and the Evening Sun, when I came on, or maybe a little thereafter, once we expanded to the zone coverage, there were probably about 500 people working in the newsroom. There's probably about 60 right now. So at the point at which Justin left, I famously have mocked the phrase more with less. Nobody does more with less. You do less with less. That's why they call it less. And so we had a depth of coverage that was different. You know, I worked on that beat, Roger Twigg, Ann Lalordo, Katie Gunther. There were a bunch of people working it with me. And so I was the new person, and I was working the 4-to-12 shift, but I had a lot of resource behind me. And I didn't have to cover the beat alone, you know, drive myself crazy with how much I was missing. There were also county reporters in every county who were covering those police departments. So it was just a fat newspaper in a good way. The city was different in that, listen, there were probably 100,000 more people in the city at that time. It was a large, you know, there were less vacants, less vacant lots, less brownfields. the crime culture that I got thrown into was, you know, Baltimore's always been a very big drug town. There was a lot of heroin. Cocaine had not yet become the tour de force that it was by the mid and late 80s when I first got there. There were some people shooting speedballs, and there were people snorting cocaine, of course, but the rock, the Ready Rock and crack cocaine had not yet had its run. So, you know, when I got to town, there were probably 15 to 20 open air drug markets, most of them in the high rise projects or in the low rises. And by the time the cocaine epidemic hit, there were maybe 80, 90 corners. It was wild. And the police department was not totally consumed with fighting the drug war. The police department was doing a variety of things, some of them good, some of them bad, but they were still engaged in policing on a variety of levels. Somewhere in the middle of that drug war, by the time I left in 95, the police department was losing itself in drug prohibition and mass arrest. And certainly while we were doing The Wire, that happened overwhelmingly in the early aughts. And although there have been some efforts to walk away from that disaster programmatically in later years, by and large, they're in trouble now. They've trained a couple of generations of police how not to do police work and instead how to fight the drug war, which is not police work. So we're in trouble. It's going to be it's not going to be an easy road back because a lot of institutional memory and a lot of institutional ethic has left the city.
Yeah, certainly. And I think you're touching on a lot of language there that I think you're pretty fluent in. You can tell in your writing, both across the books and the TV shows, and that our listeners might recognize a little bit. But I guess that takes me back to Homicide and the story that I got from you choosing to go on and write it. And I actually read it for the first time at the beginning of this year, and I loved it. What really prompted you to take on like such a massive undertaking? You take a leave of absence from the Sun. You embed yourself with a department that you're familiar with, but I'm sure that was a little anxiety inducing. What was that whole process like?
Well, I'd been there 4 years covering the beat, and we had a strike at the paper, a very brief week-long strike, which made me quite angry at management because the paper was incredibly profitable. We all knew it. In fact, we didn't even know how profitable it was until, you know, they put the paper up for sale a couple years later. And we realized, my God, the profit margins were 30%, but they were trying to cut our medical. And they were trying to cut back on our medical because they were getting ready for a sale. So I was very, you know, I was in a very bad mood about the newspaper's behavior during that strike. So I came back to the newsroom off the picket line. And I'd had a conversation once. A couple previous Christmases, I guess. It was about a year and a half earlier. I took a bottle of whiskey up to the Homicide unit because you were, as a reporter, you were always asking those guys for details on deadline. You know, there's always a murder at 10:30 at night and you're trying to get it in the home final and you're asking them to step away from their job to help you do yours. So, you know, one of the standard things you did was, hey, thanks for all the, you know, thanks for picking up the phone and thanks for coming out of that house on, you know, whatever, on Rexmere Road and talking to me about what was going on inside because I was on deadline. So, you know, bring him a bottle of Jack Daniels and wish him Merry Christmas. I happened to stay in the unit that Christmas Eve. And I ended up writing sort of a darkly funny column about Christmas in the Homicide unit that ran in the paper. But while I was up there, there was a detective named Bill Lanzi. And he's a nice guy. And Lanzi, he's an older man. And he said something off. He was just talking about the year that they had just had. And he said, you know, if somebody were to have stayed up here for this whole year and just watched, they'd have had a book. And I heard him say that, and I didn't think much of it until the strike happened. And then I thought, you know, it might be good to get out of this newsroom for a year and do something on my own. So I asked for a leave of absence, and I asked the police department if they'd let me in. I promised not to report anything during the year. I promised, you know, I promised not to be the source of leaks or anything like that. I just wanted to write a book. And on very little else, the police commissioner let me into the unit as an observer. And so I followed a shift of detectives. And I watched them work. And, you know, some of them were very good. Some of them were very good investigators. Some of them were okay. And some of them were very marginal. But the unit as a whole every squad had somebody in it that could basically keep a level of viability up. That, you know, the unit as a whole, they solved about 70% of the cases from that year. That year was 1988. And so I wrote a book about that, and it was made into a television show, much to my surprise.
Yeah, exactly. What are some things that I think, you know, I would phrase this as, you were familiar with the unit, you knew all the guys, presumably, at least by the way that you write it, it sounds that way, and by the way that you're talking here.
I didn't know all of them when I went in. So you spend a year with people, you get to know people. But
right, exactly. So you get to know them a little bit.
There were some who I'm not sure I knew them well to this day, but there are some that I knew very well.
Gotcha. So you get to know them a little bit better just by osmosis, I guess. So what are some things that you think you learned in the process of making that book that you wouldn't have if you just kind of remained on the beat?
I learned how fundamental it is that crimes get what they get and no more from society, which is to say, a murder sounds like an extraordinary act, but when you have 230 of them a year in a city like Baltimore, and you have 36 detectives in the entire unit, people are going to give a serious shooting or a homicide a shake for a week or two. And then unless there's some movement in the case, you develop an investigative path, you're going to move on to the next case. And that's particularly going to happen if the victim is uninfluential, or it's not a neighborhood that is considered particularly elemental to tourism or to the tax base. You know, when the have-nots get killed, credibly, it got a detective standing over the body and trying to do a few things and see what, and talking to the victim's family and talking to, you know, any potential witnesses and picking up the phone when there's a tip. And, you know, you did what you could, but, you know, after 4 or 5 days, the phone would ring again. And that whole sense of it being an assembly line and all the imperfections mass production of criminal investigations of homicide files, is a little unnerving, because, you know, we're all raised on a TV culture that says it's, you know, when somebody murders another, it's just supposed to matter. And, you know, big city life isn't like that, disturbingly enough. In some ways, it was impressive that every murder got, you know, got a shake, because in truth, a lot of the, you know, if it was a non-fatal shooting and it didn't come to homicide, it stayed in the district, the investigation might be, who shot you, do you know? And if they said no, they'd say, okay, wrote my report and now I'm going back on the street. I mean, you know, it was a little disturbing in a way, but that's what the book was about. It was about the assembly line that is criminal investigation in a city like Baltimore.
Yeah, it's interesting you put it that way, because I think one of the things that I'm going to remember from the book probably forever is the LaTanya Wallace case, which you talk about as one that kind of does get all the attention. And then there's, you know, however many hundred other cases in the book that I'm probably not going to remember as well.
So, right. LaTanya Wallace, which was the murder of this very young 12-year-old girl who was sexually assaulted and then killed in Reservoir Hill. They worked that case for the whole year, and they didn't. They didn't solve it. They worked it hard. They interrogated one suspect who was probably their best suspect 3 times. They did not have a sufficient case to take it in front of a jury. And, you know, it's unsolved to this moment. It's interesting because, you know, there's the two detectives who were the leads on that, the sergeant and the detective were the leads on that. They later ran afoul of a couple of their cases that have been, you know, where they are said to have charged the wrong person, and the state's attorney has not pursued a new case after new evidence is developed. And, you know, I've been asked about that, which is like, you know, these guys were the elemental characters in your book. What do you think about that? said, well, you know, I have not, you know, I don't know what happened to those cases in 87. I wasn't there in the unit. And I can only say that it's notable that, you know, I mean, I knew a lot of detectives who, when you asked them what their worst fear was, they said locking up the wrong guy. But if they did in fact do that, the year that I had with them, they caught Latanya Wallace and they worked it for 10 months and then they never put charges on anyone. So I have the opposite narrative. That doesn't invalidate the narrative that they may have charged the wrong people in 1987. But it's interesting. You know, I mean, I had the dynamic where when they got to December, they had developed a sufficient amount of evidence to consider charging somebody with the rape and murder of this little girl, and then they didn't do it. So.
Yeah, definitely. And it's pretty heavy stuff. And I guess that sort of is an interesting segue into the making of the TV show Homicide, which is kind of this, I haven't seen a ton of it. I'm a little bit younger. But from what I understand of it, it's more of like this procedural NBC drama, not really as much of a comparison to some of your later work. What was the process of getting that show made? And when you look back on it, how would you summarize that experience of going from a beat reporter to a major kind of writer and producer on a show like that?
I have to credit that show to Tom Fontana and Baltimore's own Barry Levinson. They were the people who, it was Gail Mutrix in Barry's office who got a hold of a copy of the book and said, you know, and at that point, I think they were in discussions with NBC about creating a TV show. In fact, I think they were going to create a TV show out of the movie Diner. And NBC balked at that for some reason. And then they said, well, what about this book about homicide? And NBC said, sure, we'll do a cop show. So the book went out there and they came to town, and the show was really their creation off of, I mean, I provided them with source material, but the template belongs to Tom and Barry and to an extent, Paul Antanasio, who wrote the pilot. And I shouldn't stand and take credit because, you know, at some point, the truth is Gail came to me and said, would you like to try to write the pilot for us? And I said, hell no, I don't know what I'm doing. I've never written a script in my life. Get somebody who knows what they're doing. If after you guys get something set up, there's a template for what an hour script is supposed to look like, I'll try my hand at one, but I'm not going to try to construct a show. I don't know anything. And that's what happened is after the show was up and running, they gave me a script and I wrote a script that was so dark and depressing that NBC didn't want to make it the first season. They actually said, no, we're not shooting that one. That's disturbing. And then somewhere between the first and this very abbreviated second season of the show, because the show was on almost didn't get a renewal at all, and then it got a renewal for four episodes after the first season. Mark Johnson, Barry's producing partner, got Robin Williams to be the guest star on that script that I had written. He was willing to take the lead guest star, the lead role of the husband whose wife is murdered in a street robbery. And once he did that, now NBC went, oh, we're getting Robin Williams. Now we'll make the depressing script. So that script got made and actually won the WGA award of all things. And about half of it was still belonged to myself and my friend David Mills, we rewrote it together. And after that, they offered me another script. And then after I wrote the second script, then they offered me a job. And that was at the same moment that the Baltimore Sun was having its third buyout in terms of beginning. They were beginning to retrench. They were not going to be the newspaper I had hoped they would become or remain. We were, in fact, going to go the other way. We were going to start leeching out talent. And I was the third buyout in 1995. So at the moment that they gave me a year's salary to leave the Sun, I went to work for the show Homicide. And they taught me how to write television and produce television. That was my tutorial.
It's funny how it seems like NBC seemed to have a lot of people with that at the time doing that kind of thing, because they had Larry David doing Seinfeld and he's like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Why are you bringing me in? But yeah, it's kind of cool how, you know, you can throw the right talent and the right mind at something and they'll sort of figure out the rest.
I mean, that's right. But again, to credit Tom and Barry, I was nailing in boards to the house that they were the designer. They were the architects.
Right.
And I don't, you know, I mean, I brought whatever knowledge of the reel I had, but, you know, it was, you know, and I thought it was a beautifully constructed show, and I thought there was a lot of beautiful writing in it and some real wisdom. But it was not hard to the ground of what I knew crime culture and policing to be in Baltimore in the same sense. It was, and the other thing that was different is that as a network show, pre-premium cable, it was 22 episodes that were more or less unlinked. You know, they were all, it was like a
case of the week.
To say it as literature, it was Joyce's Dubliners. It wasn't Ulysses or it was a series of short stories. And they were beautiful short stories. And some of them were incredibly artistic and incredibly well written. But they were all not linked. And I think the next thing that interested me was the idea of what if on one of these cable stations, you just told one story and you told it over 10 or 12 or 13 hours. So that was the next sort of frontier for me anyway.
So how does your relationship with HBO begin then? And what was kind of your original inspiration for putting pen to paper with The Wire? I know you turned The Corner into a miniseries for them. So that was it.
That was the bridge. Yeah. The second thing that happened was at the time that I left, when I left The Sun in 95. In 93, 2 years earlier, I took a second leave of absence to go to an open-air drug market, but basically a neighborhood that was drug saturated up in Monroe and Fayette. And we met people, myself and Ed Burns, he'd been a former homicide detective and a source of mine, a good source of mine. I can say that now. And he had taught school at Hamilton Middle for about 7 years. And we decided to write a book about sort of a year in this neighborhood and what the overlay of the drug culture and the drug war was doing to the neighborhood. So we wrote this book and 2 years later, I took the buyout. I still had to finish the book. It didn't come out till 97. But while I was working on it, I learned how to write television on homicide. And then there was this moment of where Tom Fontana did a show on HBO called Oz about a prison tier or about Oswald Penitentiary. And it was so dark and so unlike anything I'd seen on TV. I couldn't believe that HBO was putting something on like that. You gotta remember, HBO was not HBO yet. They had not started doing original programming. They were basically a movie channel, movies and boxing. So here comes Oz. And I had thought what I'd written about this drug corner, effectively, they were never gonna make it into television. I had no aspirations that it would become television. But suddenly I'm watching Oz and I'm thinking, who are these guys at HBO? And Tom, can we do something here? I got this book. And it's coming out. And Tom said, let me take it to Barry. And they had a conversation. And Barry, God bless him, was a little bit wary of making it The Corner into television. He felt like Baltimore had endured a lot with homicide. And he didn't see The Corner as being something he wanted to be engaged with. And that was fair. But Tom, to his great credit, called HBO on my behalf and said, look, you know, I'm joined with Barry at the hip, where it's Levinson Fontana Productions. So we're not going to do it with you, but let me see if I can get you set up. And he arranged that. And he arranged a meeting with HBO. And the book went off to them. And I walked into a room with Chris Albrecht and Carolyn Strauss and Carrie Antholis. And Carrie had read the book. And he actually came out to Baltimore to talk to me. And I drove him around. And so they said, well, we'll do this as a miniseries. And they said, anyone you want to write with? And I said, I gave him a couple names. And they jumped at one name, and I knew why right away. My friend David Mills, who I wrote my first script with, was an African-American writer. We had been at the Diamondback together at Maryland. And we were just friends. We'd moved past race in that way that you do when you have a long friendship with somebody. He was a newspaper reporter. He was working at the he'd been working at the Washington Post when we wrote the first script, and then he'd since gone out to L.A. to be a television writer. And they knew Mills, and they knew he was sort of a black writer operating at the highest rungs of network television. And they said, can you get David to do this miniseries, to write this miniseries? Because they really wanted some cover. They didn't want a white guy writing it alone. They were scared of that. They said, can you write it with David? And I said, okay. That's why I couldn't write it with Ed, two white guys. So I wrote the scripts with my friend David, and it got made. It won a few Emmys. And they said, what else you got? That was it. That was a long time ago, and I've been with HBO ever since that What Else You Got.
Yeah, definitely. And that was a big moment, I think, both for you and for them. I think The Wire, it's really ahead of its time when you go back and watch it. It doesn't hold the viewer's hand. It brings kind of that new main storyline into each season. It's almost an anthology in some ways in that respect.
Yeah.
Did you have the idea that you were going to do things a lot differently than police procedurals, or did you just have the writing and the structure just sort of flow to you naturally?
Yeah, no, I think we knew we specifically wanted to build something different. There were police procedurals had become the dominant form of a lot of network television. I mean, between Homicide and NYPD Blue and Law and Order, they were all over the map. I mean, they were everywhere, and we weren't going to do that any better. What I was more interested in was building a city and showing the city and all of its attendant problems and politics and the reasons why we can't recognize our problems anymore very well, much less solve any of them. It was a political critique, and I was really interested in that. And so we wanted to sort of start to construct the city season by season and start adding on. And, you know, I didn't know how much time we'd have or whether they'd keep renewing the show. And I had to fight for it last couple seasons because it was, you know, we didn't exactly have an audience. But that's what we really wanted to get into the why of why things are the way they are. Not so much the procedural aspects of whether or not you're going to catch the bad guy or any of that nonsense. So that's what we were chasing. And they let us alone. They let us do it. And it's pretty great sinecure to have of a network that basically is letting you. I mean, I do remember that moment where after the first season, I went in to explain what the second season would be about. And I was explaining that we're going to go to the port of Baltimore and we're going to do the working class and we're going to, you know, it's going to be a completely separate storyline. And, you know, and Chris Albrecht turned to Carolyn Strauss and said, "Is that what we bought?" It's like, come on, you know. But, you know, in the end, they backed it, and God bless them.
So you enter each season with specific themes and ideas, probably like one or two main ones that you want to hit on. So you mentioned that you take them to the second season with the idea that we're going to change the setting, we're going to effectively change the racial politics. Is that something that I guess you intentionally went into each season with, we're going to hit on this theme and we're going to write around it? Or I said, was it just
first you have to explain to yourself why you're doing what you're doing. Right. What's the point? What's the purpose? And the purpose of the second season for us was, make no mistake, the drug culture that we showed you in the first season is not a function. It's not a function of race. It's a function of class and poverty and economics. We live in a time of deindustrialization and the debt and automation and the death of work. We don't need as many workers as we once did to run our economy. So labor is being devalued. And this is the overlay or the press, you know, the staging really for the factory that are the drug corners, where an underground economy fueled by human desire exists alongside the shuttered factories of mid-century, you know, mid-20th century America. You know, we don't need these kids who are going up to the corners for a legitimate economy. So they find a place where their existential crisis is solved and where they can earn a living for as long as they don't fall as victims and as soldiers do. But we felt that was the need for the second season, which is basically to show that, you know, every time the economy shrugs, as Ed Burns said, it throws more people onto the corner. And so we did that with a bunch of white and black working class stevedores, who aren't that different from the kids on the corner when you shake it. Third season, we did, we introduced the political element and address ourselves to the possibility of reform on a local level. Can anybody seize the reins and fix anything? Fourth season was education, and fifth was the media culture. And in the end, the other overlay to all The Wire was if there was one specific policy argument we were making, is that the drug war has to end. We have to We have to abandon that. We have to kick it to the curb and never pick it up again, because until you do, you're not going to be able to. I mean, never mind the damage that the drug war has done to communities and families and people, but it's destroyed law enforcement. And until you give up on the idea of drug prohibition and mass arrest, all your efforts to reform the police and have the police become a viable force for, you know, legitimate order, you know, and legitimate justice, they have to stop doing what they're doing, or it won't work. The efficacy of the reform will be minimal.
Yeah, that is the theme that is, I think, most consistent across your work, going back to Homicide, where you have, I think, McLarney talking about, you know, Gene Cassidy's, you know, that whole situation and how that he's kind of like this foot soldier or something to that effect in that anecdote. And then it's kind of in The Wire. It's interesting because The Wire seems sort of directly in dialogue with what was going on in the Middle East. I'm sure you were writing it before 9/11, at least at first. But how quickly in the show's tenure do you think you guys in the writer's room became conscious of the social commentary you were including that looped in that whole situation? And how quickly did you become aware that it was resonating with people in that way?
I don't think we were ever clear what was resonating, because the audience kept going down after season two. We went up from one to two, and we figured that was because we had more white people on screen.
Right.
You know, it's just, what else can you say? This show was more accessible to more viewers, more American viewers, whatever. And then from season three on, we were counter-programmed by the NFL. They began Sunday Night Football, and so we never really quite recovered our audience. We skirted along with a very polite small number on Sunday nights all the way to the end of season five. So I don't think what's resonating. I mean, I don't think I realized that The Wire had legs until we'd been off the air for 3-4 years,
You've been joking about that on Twitter a little bit recently.
Yeah, but it's true. I mean, I'm not being hyperbolic. I mean, more people found The Wire when we were done than while we were filming. That is absolutely true. A few things happened. It became a word of mouth phenomenon in the UK, and then in other European countries. It did much better in other European countries faster than it spread in America. And then they finally got all the DVD box sets out. I mean, they didn't put the DVD box sets out until we'd filmed and broadcast three seasons. Nobody remembers that, but box sets at that time, this is before streaming, became this otherworldly economy for television shows. It just became a big deal. And, you know, all of a sudden somebody handed me something that said, you know, you just moved 500,000 units of The Wire in the last 6 months. And I was like, what? Yeah, you're selling DVDs. That's how people are finding the show. It was really improbable. Sui generis, you know, I couldn't do it again if I tried. And I haven't tried, so.
Yeah, it happens to musicians a lot, doesn't it? Where, you know, one, you know, hit or whatever doesn't connect until somebody's, you know, passed away or something like that. It's unfortunate, I guess, but it speaks to staying power, I guess, and the cream of the crop ultimately rises.
Well, you know, the other thing that happened was premium cable became a lending library, and it's even more so now because of streaming. I don't worry so much about the fact that nobody watches the stuff on, you know, on its premiere night. They watch it later during the week, or during the next week, or they hold all 6 or all 10 until they can binge watch it, or they don't watch it for 2 years, and then all of a sudden they're scrolling through HBO Max and they say, you know what, I heard something about this show, I'm going to watch an episode and see if I like it. And, you know, I mean, I get, like, people send me, you know, posts or whatever, you know, or emails, and they say, hey, this show, Generation K, oh my God, Treme is really, I really like Treme. You know, where were you 10 years ago? Where were you? You know, I joke about it, but I'm happy. I mean, the stuff has a shelf life. Nobody anticipated that for television when I started in on it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, in 20 years when people start to find the deuce, I'm sure you'll be very happy about that too. But so I guess last sort of thought I had on The Wire, and it sort of ties into what we're going to last touch on here. It's the idea of, and this is not my word, I'm not smart enough, but institutional inertia was kind of the term that I found on it, where wherein people are just kind of trying to survive another day, and that the country has kind of slowly turned into people just kind of trying to cover their own ass and stay afloat in like this ocean of bureaucracy. So how long have you been?
It's the failure of policy and of will, of national will. I don't think we actually can attend. We're very good at politics in this country. We play political games 24/7. We play them at every conscious level. Everything is dragged through the political prism of whatever election cycle you're in. We're really good at politics. We are terrible. I mean, we are miserable at governance. We don't know how to address a problem. We don't know how to solve a problem. We don't know how to get past our own rhetoric. And it's become worse and worse. And that is the tone of the wire.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's interesting how it ties into what you're working on now, or just wrapped up working on with We Own This City. And to me, in reading Justin's book, I read it when it first came out, then I put it down. So maybe I'm a little gray on some of the specifics of the matter. But to me, it kind of seems like the Gun Trace Task Force was ostensibly designed to like kind of cut through red tape and like make tangible change. And it's sort of ironic, and it almost feels like a Wire subplot in its own way, wherein the people that are created to do that end up preying on their citizens and end up kind of being the worst example of the worst of the incompetent policing that you're talking about. So what was the first time you ever heard of the GTTF, and how did what they did either contradict or line up with what you knew about the BPD after all the decades that you had worked with them?
I mean, listen, it sort of stands as a coda to what we were saying with The Wire. If policy-wise, what we were saying with The Wire was end the drug war, We Own This City is saying end the drug war, except all the letters are capitalized and there's a period between every word. It's the same nightmare, but it's a generational collapse that takes you from one level of dystopic institutional behavior to a much deeper and darker level. When I was a police reporter, you certainly knew that there was police violence that could happen in an alley between two people. And if there weren't a plethora of unimpeachable witnesses, the officer's version of what happened in that alley and why somebody needed to get hit or beat would prevail. We all knew that. That had been going on since the first time they ever handed any patrolman a nightstick. And we all knew or sensed, I certainly had a lot of, and there were times where people would get caught improbably. They would do something really stupid or really reckless. We all knew that there would be plainclothesmen who were working vice units that, they would kick in a door and they'd turn over a mattress. There'd be $10,000 and maybe 8,000 or 7,000 would get down to evidence control, and maybe 1,000 or 1,500 would go back to the suspect being arrested so he wouldn't squawk, and the rest would go in your pocket. And I'm not saying every cop did that, and I'm not saying even most cops did that, but you knew it could happen, and you knew it probably did happen. We wrote the last words of The Wire off of that kind of police culture in 2007. 15 years later, which is a lifetime in an institution like the police department, because you got to remember the average career is probably 20, 25 years. There are guys coming up who, it's not just about stealing from drug dealers, they were stealing from citizens. And it's not just about stealing the money, they were stealing the drugs and then selling them back on the street to other drug dealers. They were doing home invasions. That's a level of cynicism, and it was unit-wide in the Gun Trace Task Force that, I covered a lot of the police department, I knew a lot of the people who were doing stuff, and I had my suspicions, but I did not have a unit doing that kind of there was no unit doing that in the 90s, and even in the aughts when we were following the police department and talking to a variety of sources to do that show, the Gun Trace Task Force was the next generation, because the institution is not static. If the policy is traumatizing and disastrous, and it's breeding the worst things in an institution, which the drug war is, then each generation is going to be worse than the next until you change the mission. If you don't change the mission, you eventually end up at the bottom of the hole, and that's where Baltimore is now. In The Wire, we showed you cops putting their putting the cash inside their raid vests to keep it. We showed you cops beating on people on spec with the security of knowing they could write it up the right way. We showed you all that stuff. What we didn't show you was something as utterly devoid of integrity or ethic as, you know, something as utterly, I can't even come up with the adjective, as the Gun Trace Task Force. And yes, that was a unit that was originally started, it was a paper unit to trace guns, but it very quickly became activated and became a street level jump out unit. And it attracted all the worst cops, because that's the kind of unit where you, if you're going to get paid and only to get paid, you can do that kind of police work. So, yeah.
So when did you learn that Justin Fenton was writing a book on the topic, and how quickly did an idea for an adaptation come together? I'd imagine you were kind of one of the first people that was kind of being looked at or tapped to do something like this.
It's weird. It was a big circle. I read Justin's reporting in The Sun. You know, I knew Justin. We'd had some conversations about the beat. He was obviously, you know, doing the same gig I used to do at The Sun. And when I started reading the coverage in detail about what was going on with that task force, I said to him, you have a book and you need to write this as a book. And I went so far as to call my book agent and give him Justin's name. And then I gave Justin Rafe Sigalin's phone number. And I said, you know, help him. This should not just be daily coverage in The Sun. This should be a published narrative. It's just an appalling story. And then I didn't think anything more about it. I had done that because it seemed like it was journalistically sound to suggest that to him. And because I like Justin and, you know, felt like he was writing a story that, you know, he deserved a compass. But I didn't think about it as television. Lo and behold, a year and a half later, Carrie Antholis, who I'd worked with before at HBO, but also was a good friend of George Polkonis's, one of my writing partners on The Wire and other shows, he went to George he had a copy of Justin's early manuscript. And he went to George and said, what do you think? And George brought it to me and to Nina Noble, and said, what do you think? And I said, yeah, this is picking up right where The Wire left off. So I didn't have a plan to come back. I wasn't thinking, oh, Baltimore sure needs to hear from us again. You know, I mean, it was like, I felt like you guys had enough bites of the apple between Homicide the Corner and The Wire. You'd had enough, but this thing really spoke to where the drug war was headed in this country. And I didn't want to miss the opportunity to drive a few more nails into the idea that drug prohibition has done anything for this country other than harm us, all of us. And so that's how it happened. George was really the conduit and the instigator of the miniseries. And I should also tell this story. I probably should too, which is after Homicide of the Corner, I knew The Wire was going to be a very deliberate critique of the drug war. And it was going to be very critical of where the police departments and the Baltimore Police Department by specifics, had lost its way. And so I actually, I bought a charity lunch at a charity event with the new mayor, Marty O'Malley. And I took him to lunch, him and his chief of staff, went to Soda Sopra on Charles Street. And I said to him, I said, look, I'm doing this show. It's a much darker show than Homicide. It's really a criticism of the drug war and how it's being fought and what's resulting from it. And Baltimore, you guys have had two big bites of the apple with Homicide in the Corner. You don't have to take this show. I can do this show in Philly. I can do it in Cleveland or San. It could be in any Rust Belt city. I can set it anywhere. I'm here. We have a crew. I would do it, but I need to know that you're okay with it, because it's not going to be a pleasant narrative. And I mean, I was very direct about that. And he said, oh, no, sure. We love the shows. We love having the film industry involved. Do it here. After the first season, Marty canceled our permits to film the second season because he was so mad about what the show was. And I was like, I had lunch with you over this, you know, I told you. It's like, what? And I said, don't you remember we went to Soda Sopra? You know, he's like, I didn't think it would be this, you know. Sorry. So again, forgive us our trespasses.
And thus, Baldwin. Tommy Carchetti was born.
Yeah. Well, actually, and Tommy. Well, we were going to do politics anyway, but yeah, I had a little bit of fun transmuting some of our young mayor's callowness to the Carchetti character. I will confess.
Yeah, I bet. So I'm fascinated by Wayne Jenkins. I look at the guy from the book, you know, military background, highly charismatic, extremely prolific, but he had some obvious, like, really deep-seated issues, manipulative tendencies. I'm already seeing that come through in the first two episodes. How would you describe the process of adapting a very real person like that, who's almost stranger than fiction, into a TV character with John Bernthal?
I mean, you need to have these delicate moments of humanity where, like, he scrapes against his own conscience, even if the conscience that he has is being shouted down or being stunted by his desires. You need to show him being familial, having things to which he's loyal. You need to do all those things, because ultimately, without those little delicate moments, it just comes across as a one note, you know, tyrant. He's a damaged soul. You get to the point of, and he's there. And somebody said in the show, you know, one of his collaborators says very aptly, says there's more than one Wayne Jenkins, which is maybe another way of saying it. You know, the same guy that could go out there and, you know, go right to Madame and jump into the police line and, you know, carry injured officers to safety and take up a shield and, you know, join the police line and go out and buy $600 worth of chicken boxes for officers who'd been out there, you know, in the middle of the uprising for as long as they had. That's one Wayne Jenkins. And then later on that same night, he'd go to a drugstore that was being looted and he'd find all the oxy and steal it so he could sell it back on the street. And both of those creatures are Wayne Jenkins. So you need to get a good actor. And, you know, John Bernthal, he really surrounded the role. You know, he researched it heavily. There were moments where he showed up having made choices to wardrobe or to a, you know, slight dialogue change or something. And I'd ask him about it. And like, where did that come from? And why are we doing that? And he'd pull out a picture. I mean, I remember once he was, John showed up in this courtroom scene and he's wearing a raid vest during a motions hearing on the stand. I'd never seen a guy wear a raid jacket on the stand in a Baltimore Circuit courtroom, you know, certainly not, but it was a motions hearing. There was no jury in. So I get that, but I just never see, you know, why are you wearing a bulletproof vest in the courtroom? And, I said, that's wrong. I said, send him back to wardrobe. And he said, wait, wait, wait. And he pulled out his phone and he showed me a picture of Wayne Jenkins on the stand at a motions hearing in a raid vest. And I'm, you know, okay, I stand corrected. You know, I mean, John was as aggressive in researching this role as we were in writing it.
I guess I'll close you out here. This story, like you mentioned, it's a true story, unlike The Wire. The Wire almost, like, it feels to me like a very clear work of fiction that is based upon real ideas. This is not a work of fiction, and it feels like it covers some, to your point, like darker and more cynical things that you ever wrote about, I think.
Yeah.
How do you keep, like, faith that things can get better after all these years? How would you impart?
I don't.
How would you impart?
I'm sorry, but I don't. I mean, look, I'm not a depressed person. I go to the, you know, I go see the Orioles play. I take walks, I play with my kids, you know, I hang out, you know, I drink a beer. I'm the same as anybody else. In a day-to-day life, I don't live the life of somebody who's waiting for the other shoe to drop on the entire society. On the other hand, I was trained as a reporter and I can tell when things are going bad. And I think everything from our media culture right now to our politics are such that I don't think we're going to be solving the problems we need to solve. And I don't know where that takes us you know, at a certain point, if people get frustrated enough, it takes you to fascism, which we've been dancing around with these last few years. Or it takes you to a place where the center can't hold because nobody has any faith anymore. The only thing I can do is, you know, it's like I tell the stories I think are worth telling and I believe in them. And it's like at least people will not be able to say they didn't know. I can say that much. And I try to vote the right way and I try to argue for what I think is correct. But if you're asking me how I keep faith, I don't. I don't think it's going to end well.
So is just kind of the one takeaway that you want people to bring from the show is just face the truth no matter where it takes you?
End the drug war.
Yeah.
End it. Just stop it. Stop it. Recommit to police work, to what the mission has to be for the city, to help the city, to help the city survive. When I began as a police reporter years ago, clearance rate for murder was 70%. That doesn't mean 7 out of 10 people went to prison. It means 4 out of 10 went to prison when you shake out all the not guilty verdicts and all the cases that were dropped before trial, which, you know, God bless us. That, you know, that's the way the system's not supposed to find everybody guilty, and the system's not supposed to take every case that was strong enough to charge or even strong enough to indict into trial. At some point, you know, there's some discretion and there's on the part of juries and prosecutors that, so I'm not suggesting that. But 4 out of 10 people, if you killed somebody in Baltimore City when I started looking at this stuff, 4 out of 10 people who did that would see the inside of a prison cell for some time. Now it's like 1 in 10. That's a function of the drug war. It's because we've got really good at jumping out on corners and locking everybody up, 100, even up to 100,000 people a year in a city of 620,000. We got really good at locking up everybody for nothing. And we taught police that that was police work. So they can't do the work that identifies an actual shooter or a robber or a raper or a burglar and targets them with criminal investigation that actually succeeds and can bring a case into court. Those skill sets are dead because they didn't pay for those skill sets. They paid for grabbing everybody with a bag of dope or 2 vials or 10 vials and throwing them into the courthouse. That's what they paid for and that's what they got. So we have cops who can only do that. We have a generation of police, 2 generations of police now, that can only do the drug work because that's what they paid for. That's what they valued. They valued these guys in the GTTF. They valued the Wayne Jenkinses of the world. We got to get back to valuing the people who can actually do police work. Or the city's going to have 350 murders a year as it now does and not 230 as it once did when I started doing this. So, yeah, I mean, end the drug war. I can't. I know I sound like a broken record. I can't help it. Keep saying that over.
I mean, I think you're doing the right thing, from my opinion, to continue to put that out there, no matter how much people, you know, come back at you, and you know, you get in these fights on Twitter with people that tell you, you know, one cynical thing after the other. I think you're.
Well, that's the other thing I do for fun.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, but you know, it's reflective of really, really important work that you do for a city that I care a lot about. That you know. People that I'm close to care a lot about that I hope has a pretty strong future. And I know you do too. So I really appreciate you hopping on here.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great. How about you go and promote the show a little bit, let the people know where they can find it. I'm sure they've already heard, but if not, why don't you go ahead and pitch it.
You know, if you tweet something at me, I'll retweet it. I'll throw it up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Whenever you're ready to broadcast, I'll be happy to do that.
Cool.
All right. Go O's.
Absolutely.
Go Ravens.
All right. Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age?
What are they giving?
Everything out of me. They gonna get a Super Bowl out of me. Need that.